Paper 19, Section 5, is where we're ready to start, which is old single column, page 219. All right. Just I think one thing I'll say before we start reading is the first time you saw the name Inspired Trinity Spirits, the question you should have had is, what does that word inspired mean? Why is that in their name? So hopefully, as we're reading, maybe we'll see something that will give us a clue. just pointing that out. I mean, try to get yourself, you know, in a curiosity mode even before you start reading. You know, when you go to a section, try to have a question in your mind that you're looking for the answer to when you first engage it. It'll help you have all the more questions as you're going through. So let's see why if we can figure out where the inspiriting, you know, inspired is happening. In what sense is something inspirited?
Five, Inspired Trinity Spirits. I will be able to tell you very little concerning the Inspired Trinity Spirits, for they are one of the few holy secret orders of beings in existence. Secret, no doubt, because it is impossible for them fully to reveal themselves, even to those of us whose origin is so near the source of their creation. They come into being by the act of the Paradise Trinity and may be utilized by any one or two of the deities as well as by all three. We do not know whether these spirits are of completed numbers or are constantly increasing, but we incline to the belief that their number is not fixed.
Maybe just one little thing. If you haven't quite gotten zeroed in on the fact that there's four individualities, the three persons and then the Paradise Trinity, you just notice the way they're talking about it there. It would seem a little odd, you know, if the origin was all three, for them to mention, you know, that final, you know, little thing, as well as by all three. Okay, so even though it's the revelation is constructed, you know, in an evolutional fashion, so if you're not quite ready to recognize that the Paradise Trinity isn't just the association of the three persons, it's constructed in such a way that you can sort of abide in that old mode of thought without, you know, being challenged too soon. You know, they're very masterful at trying to be as gentle in their engagement of you as possible. But you know, their modus operandi is to challenge every single thought you've ever had and take a machete to most of them. But they try to be as gracious as possible so that you're not quite ready to let go of the Trinity of Christendom. You don't have to. You know, and we all know lots of longtime readers
don't.
You know, go, oh, I never noticed, you know. And that's not really because of any inadequacy on the reader's part. It's the revelators have very carefully made it that way to only challenge you when you're ready to be challenged. But certainly when you decide you're ready to be challenged, every single sentence is going to, you know, come at you.
Right. We fully understand neither the nature nor the conduct of the inspired spirits. They may possibly belong to the category of superpersonal spirits. They seem to operate over all known circuits and appear to act well nigh independently of time and space. But we know little about them except as we deduce their character from the nature of their activities, the results of which we certainly observe here and there in the universes.
Okay. They observe the results of their activities. Okay. Hence the well nigh part. But basically, they're telling you that their nature is independent a finite space and time. And then they have some, you know, like so many things do, some sort of very mysterious ability to interface with finite space and time to a greater or lesser degree, you know, just like a thought adjuster or whatnot. But see, that should be giving you a clue already. See, super personal. And I'm pretty sure that they're basically an absentite, you know, person. You know, they have an absentite self with you know, ultimate personality activity at some level engaging that absentite self. They're a super person. So from a finite perspective, they're not really going to be experienceable personally. It won't be quite like a thought adjuster that is very definitively, you know, impersonal. But that whole, you know, between the lines there, that, okay, so they're fundamentally transcendental of the finite domain. But we're talking about their interaction with the finite domain. So they're basically outside, and they're reaching in and engaging. They're inspiriting the finite. So that's possibly one of the reasons why, at least, they chose that name, inspired, is that the finite domain is inspired by these transcendent beings.
Does that kind of put them on the level of the gravity messenger?
No, I mean, what they're saying is they're up there with the transcendentals. You know, they don't know at what level. Remember, there's four levels of ultimate personality activity up there. And there's seven levels of absentite nature. All very complicated, and you know, they barely can figure out what's going on with their finite footprint, let alone their root nature, you know. But you know, in some way, they're up there. The fact that they, you'll see other ways when they talk about them, and they're saying super personal. They mean that in a specific sense. They don't think that they're ultra personal, just super personal. Now you go, you know, the word personal is being used just for the finite, and then they use these prefixes to talk specifically about transcendent facts: super personal, ultra personal, omnipersonal. You know, as you go up higher and higher. Okay, so when they're saying super personal, they're saying, okay, we think that they're, you know, they don't think they're co-absolute facts way up there. You know, they're an absentite fact that's engaging the finite. That's what their suspicion is. You know, they may possibly belong. You know, and they're always very careful when they have so little to go on. There could be things that no one even understands yet that they, you know, that could be in play. But in terms of what they know, that would be the most straightforward rationalization, is that they're a super personal being. You know, and maybe just one more thing. You know, remember, fundamentally, when you say the supreme being, when you're pointing to the he-ness, you know, that's a super person. Only here we see there's a very specific, intimate, in many ways, relationship with the finite. I mean, they're zooming down and engaging point facts and stuff. Okay? Whereas the supreme being is always big picture.
With both the supreme being and these Trinity spirits being of origin in the Paradise Trinity, what separation of function do you distill that into a...
Well, I mean, you have that, I mean, the basic issues, like we've pointed out, of the functioning of the Paradise Trinity, and hence the beings that stem from the Paradise Trinity, of totality, attitudes. Who can give me another one? Coordinate action and
cosmic
over control. Now, not to mention Justice Administration when you're talking about some of the justice beings. But so there's always, it's by definition going, their activities are always going to be coordinate. And they, we've seen how they use that word over and over and over going through these Trinity Origin papers. They can't, none of these beings can help it, but to be very coordinate, very big picture, totality attitude, just because of their nature, and they seamlessly will work together in their activities because of the one source, one common source that they have. So that's, you'll see that as a, that's not going to change, that basic pattern we've seen. It's just, now we've got yet another little variation on what the Paradise Trinity has done. Oh, and maybe just to suggest that, bring in that suggestion, or part of that element of this suggestion about superpersonal, it wouldn't be so much the Trinity of Supremacy, but the Trinity of Ultimacy that you would think of as being more immediately in relationship to these beings. But then coming down through the Trinity of Supremacy, they're engaging the finite. So there's the Trinity of Ultimacy apparently is more directly involved in bringing them into existence, and then the Trinity of Supremacy is involved in bringing them into relationship with the finite. Okay, so transcendental, fundamentally, so that makes sense for there to be from an outside, something engaging in for the inspired.
Under certain conditions, these inspired spirits can individualize themselves sufficiently for recognition by beings of Trinity origin. I have seen them, but it would never be possible for the lower orders of celestial beings to recognize one of them. Certain circumstances also arise from time to time in the conduct of the evolving universes in which any being of Trinity origin may directly employ these spirits in the furtherance of his assignments. We therefore know that they exist, and that under certain conditions we may command and receive their assistance, sometimes recognize their presence. But they are not a part of the manifest and definitely revealed organization entrusted with the conduct of the time-space universes before such material creations are settled in light and life. They have no clearly discernible place in the present economy or administration of the evolving seven superuniverses. They are a secret of the Paradise Trinity.
Okay, and so, and we basically understand the secretness of it. They're reaching down from above, from the absonite down in. A couple little things in there. Notice how he mentions that apparently sometimes they're being commanded to help with some circumstance, and they're not even visible. Sometimes recognize their presence. You see, I threw that in there. So, pointing out that this using them and seeing them are not necessarily correlated. Can be one or the other or both or. And he's quite confused about it all. Sometimes they're there and they're not being used at all. And everyone probably remembers. He mentions that coming up here. Now, the one thing, if you look through the book, all the places they bring up the inspired Trinity spirits, there's a reference to before such material creations are settled in light and life. When you get a local universe settled in light and life, remember how, fundamentally what's happening there is you've lifted the local universe up to sort of the level of the super universe and are plugging it in seamlessly to that Trinity administration at the super universe level. And so all the various Trinity origin beings become much more integral in what's going on, and including the inspired Trinity spirits become very directly involved in helping out the Union of Days. Okay, so that's if you want a cross reference on that a little bit more, but even there, it's very it's just a statement. They don't really explain what exactly. But that's pretty general. I mean, a general case that they give us limited information about what goes on when things get settled in light and life. You know, they give us a few basic facts, but it's most of it is sort of just allusions and stuff. They don't get very specific. And obviously they could. I mean, there's a number of local universes that are well settled in light and life. They could talk extensively if they had permission about some of those details, but they don't. I mean, most likely just simply because that's, you know, that would be jumping the gun on our evolutionary process of slowly getting our local universe up to being accepted into the super universe.
Chris.
Yep.
So how do they, so it'd be like us, we can't see the angels and stuff. So it'd be kind of like, how would they know to call on if they didn't know they were even there? Was it by faith?
No, not going to be that. It's going to.
Under certain conditions.
I mean, they'll, you know, maybe they'll just be told by their superiors that, you know, there'll be inspired Trinity spirits working with you, assign them to whatever tasks. You know, it's like, well, I see them. No, probably not on this mission. Okay. I'll just trust that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And of course you can, because I mean all these Trinity origin beings are divine. So again, remember we mentioned that's just inescapable because of the totality attitude fact that's in their nature. They're going to be divine. All right, a little bit more. Oh, you got one more question to do?
The first sentence where it says the inspired spirits can individualize themselves sufficiently. What is individualized?
Yeah, okay, so see that's in a relative to the finite is what they mean there. And so, especially when you, like we were saying, if you think about them as, in a way, transcendent of finite location, you know, so that as a purely absent fact, they're everywhere at the same time. But they can bring themselves down into focus at some localized point, apparently to greater or lesser degrees. Remember how we've talked about the thinking of the creative mother spirit as starting out as an absonite personality phenomenon that slowly condenses and focuses into the finite until it has a definitive personal foothold on the local universe headquarters world and ever more. See, that's a parallel thing. Thinking about these beings that may start with a very extensive totality attitude from the Trinity, but can bring themselves down into focus to varying degrees. Okay? So individualize. And obviously it's an individual, it's a being. But when by individualize, they mean relative to the finite. That he's going to be in this room, not everywhere in the grand universe. In terms of, and that's the thing. It's because if they're an absonite being, just in and of their nature, they're omnipresent relative to the finite. But just like an adjuster can bring itself focused right down onto just you, or just me, these inspired spirits can do the same thing. And there's always mystery in that. I mean, no one really understands that, except transcendentalists and stuff, you know, that really understand can see things from the top down. But all of us, you know, like even the author here, even the divine counselor that are looking from the bottom up, they don't really understand how that, you know, reaching down from the transcendent and engaging the finite works.
The Melchizedeks of Nebadon teach that inspired Trinity spirits are destined sometime in the eternal future to function in the places of the solitary messengers, whose ranks are slowly but certainly being depleted by their assignment as associates of certain types of Trinitized sons.
Again, if you go up to the end of the solitary messenger paper, if you remember, we mentioned this just recently again, you have these Trinitized sons of destiny, they're called. Those particular creature Trinitized sons that result from a finaliter coming into relationship with either a paradise citizen or a Havona native. You know, that those perfect, engaging, perfected combinations that result in these very transcendent creature Trinitai sons of destiny, that become the wards of the architects of the master universe. They are a solitary messenger gets assigned to each of them, and the two of them go to Vice Jerrington, never to be seen again at large. Okay, so one by one, the solitary messengers are all being taken out of service and are waiting for the end of the Grand Universe Age on Vice Jerrington. That's what they're referring to here. And this
fixed numbers.
Yeah, and there's a so that when you get to the solitary messenger paper, they'll talk about that a lot. That whole mystery of, well, is that going to keep on going until there's no solitary messengers left? And if so, who's going to take their place? And like the Melchizedeks and others think the inspired Trinity spirits are basically going to take their place. It's like, well, is that going to work? They're a lot more transcendent in their engagement to the finite than a solitary messenger. Yeah, well, if the whole local universe is, or the whole grand universe is basically getting up closer to the ceiling, you don't need to be able to engage it well. You don't have to be able to penetrate as deeply as a solitary messenger does and be definitively personal, you know, way down into the finite. So that's why they're rationalizing that way, that that makes sense, that a being that is sort of less related to the finite could serve those roles when everything is up closer to the absentite.
Gene's got a question.
Oh.
Yeah. I've noticed they've done this in other places. The Melchizedeks of Mabinon teach.
Yep.
Okay. Well, he certainly got his own opinion. and he's got a very high point of view to express them. For some reason, he inserts what the Melchizedeks of Mabinon teach.
Like you pointed out, you see that a lot. So you know that's part of the revelatory mandate that these guys are under. It's always the case, as they mention, that you only resort to a higher perspective if you have to in the revelation. You know, so if you're a midwayer, you stick with what you know unless you absolutely need to resort to something that is above your knowledge. Here again, and even specifically not saying, well, the Melchizedeks of Avalon think, you know, or whatever. Keeping it local. I mean, it's pretty likely that in some of these, the Melchizedeks of Mabinon aren't in disagreement with you know, Melchizedeks in the other local universes. They come to a similar conclusion, but they're just always, you know, referring you to your local context. They're revealing to beings that are going to be spending a long time yet working up through the local universe. They're not allowed to give us stuff that's outside of our local universe in perspective yet. That would be tainting our evolutionary ascension. Yeah, so.
Do you suspect that these solitary numbers correlate to a predictability of the number of trinitizations?
Well, see, that's one of the speculations that they bring up. You know, maybe those will just stop when they run out of, you know, the very last creature Trinitai son that can be made coincidentally is tied to the last solitary messenger, you know, or something. I mean, that wouldn't be surprising.
But that's 700 trillion, and that's only 1/7 of it.
So, not very limiting.
Yeah, you remember the kind of numbers we were talking about when we were talking about the number of finaliters, residences on Paradise. It was, you know, we were getting into numbers that were hard to even give English designations for. You know, I mean, there's so many zeros. So
beyond our concept.
Yeah. But, all right. Let's keep going here.
The inspired spirits are the solitary spirits of the universe of universes. As spirits, they are very much like the solitary messengers, except that the latter are distinct personalities. We obtain much of our knowledge of the inspired spirits from the solitary messengers, who detect their nearness by virtue of an inherent sensitivity to the presence of the inspired spirits, which functions just as unfailingly as a magnetic needle points to a magnetic pole. When a solitary messenger is near an inspired Trinity spirit, he is conscious of a qualitative indication of such a divine presence and also of a very definitive quantitative registration which enables him actually to know the classification or number of the spirit presence or presences.
Definite, quantitative registration. Okay, so both a qualitative and a quantitative. I mean, so, you know, if there's a quantitative, that's telling you something, that this being, you know, basically he's able to measure the size of the being. Okay? So it can't be extremely transcendent, or, you know, he wouldn't get a registration. It's like, well, yes, but a solitary messenger is a pretty high being. Yeah, okay, so that's telling you something as well. They could sense a pretty high fact still as being delimited. But we're not talking about something that's tied to the infinite level, say. Okay. And, you know, we already said that they're guessing that they're absentite. So, you know, that would probably feeds into the, when they say definite quantitative. It's like, this is not a projection from very high up. So the shadow cast is still really solid. He can get a really solid reading. He's not having to extrapolate way up, you know, extremely high to get this reading. Let's see. What else is in there? I mean, you know, again, you notice they call them solitary spirits. It's just, they've pretty much already decided that this is the most likely scenario, that they're really a sort of a foretaste of the solitary messengers to come, in a sense, you know. Okay, and yeah, we've mentioned the solitary messengers in this mode before. They use them as spirit test particles. You know, just like if I had a standard mass and I could move it around the universe and I could feel, oh, this mass is being tugged this much, so there must be this much other mass locally here, and I take it over here and say, oh, okay, it's being tugged this much. So I remember they used them to try to figure out, the solitary messengers, to figure out how much spirit substance there is. You know, they just, the solitary messengers just report how much spirit gravity tug they feel in various places, just like a little spirit test particle. And this is more detail about that. It's actually a pretty sophisticated measuring device for spirit energy. Both qualitative and quantitative readings that the solitary messenger gets.
You're bringing up something that I've often wondered about, even at this low level where we live, because aren't there times when you go into a place and it feels so qualitatively different? And I mean, even at our level, we can detect these mm-hmm. atmospheres that pervade certain mm-hmm. spaces, mm-hmm. and some are wonderful and some are horrible.
Right. See, and that's, remember how they talk about our relationship to spirit energy right now. It's not very direct, of course, but it's there, and we will feel, quote unquote. We're not going to measure it. We're not going to get a real quantitative, you know, or at least nothing very, very precise in terms of quantitativeness. But quality, before you can detect quantity, you can detect quality, as we're just about to see when we read a little bit more. So, yeah, you're more sensitive to that sensing. What's the quality of the unity likeness in this room? Yeah. and you'll get a vague feel for it, you know. You'll sense it. As we imagine what it's going to be like when you're an actual spirit being, a first stage spirit, you know, this is, and it's going to be very direct. Your measurement, your assessment of spirit energy, its quality, its quantity, etc. All right.
I may relate a further interesting fact. When a solitary messenger is on a planet whose inhabitants are indwelt by thought adjusters, as on Urantia, he is aware of a qualitative excitation in his detection sensitivity to spirit presence. In such instances, there is no quantitative excitation, only a qualitative agitation. When on a planet to which thought adjusters do not come, contact with the natives does not produce any such reaction. This suggests that thought adjusters are in some manner related to or are connected with the inspired spirits of the Paradise Trinity. In some way, they may possibly be associated in certain phases of their work, but we do not really know. They both originate near the center and source of all things, but they are not the same order of being. Thought adjusters spring from the Father alone. Inspired spirits are the offspring of the Paradise Trinity.
Okay, a whole bunch of things in there. I mean, when they say a further interesting fact, it's like, well, it's actually quite a few facts. Okay.
Singular.
Did you notice, the very definitive little tweaking they were trying to do to your attempt to understand the paragraph when they said center and source,
yep.
Not source and center,
right.
Center and source, right? So we're talking about the Trinity. Yeah, and mother, deity, as opposed to the flip side, source and center, father-like, phenomena. So they both originate near the center and source. Well, we've come to recognize exactly what a thought adjuster, what a father fragment is a fragment of. What's the reservoir that father fragment is individuated out of, from? And what facet of the Father?
Infinite upholder.
The infinite upholder, yeah. And you notice, thought adjusters spring, does it say thought adjusters spring from the universal Father alone? No.
No.
Very carefully, he just said the Father, talking about the deity.
Right.
And we're certainly not talking about even the facet of deity that you call the universal Father. We're talking about all six facets of deity that are called the Father together. And we know which one specifically. It's the infinite upholder. It's the infinite upholder. It's a fragment of the infinite. Not co-infinite, not absolute, not okay, the infinite. Above the level that the solitary messenger can get a quantitative reading on. It's at the highest level. It's at the infinite level. Okay, so all the solitary messenger gets is a qualitative. But, see, towards you, before the solitary messenger gets a quantitative, it can get a qualitative. So we'd be the same pattern. It's going to be the same pattern. Everything is following the same pattern like this. So now don't be surprised if you have some vague qualitative sense about the spirit energy. That's a foot in a situation. Without any definitive quantitative. After all, until the fifth epical revelation, no one ever even thought of thinking of spirit as a substance, where you talk about quantity. Right? So there's that. And, okay, so specifically, what's in play? Center and source. We're talking about what comes from the Paradise Trinity. We're talking about Mother Deity. And is there a very immediate relationship between the things that are directly tied to the Paradise Trinity, like an inspired Trinity spirit, and the infinite upholder? Yes, that's the way we fundamentally understand the foundation of the Mother. The Paradise Trinity functioning at different levels in relationship to the infinite upholder gives us a downstepped expression of the infinite upholder. Like the Trinity of Supremacy in relationship to the infinite upholder super additive consequence of that relationship is the finite upholder. The universal mother. God the Supreme is God the Mother. Okay? It's the finite upholder. Yeah, there's a very definitive relationship between the two. Or, you know, to look at it from the Father's side, when you get up to the infinite level, where the infinite upholder is, that's the Father as the Mother. That's one way of saying it. Or another way is, you know, you've actually transcended really the meaning of the distinction between Father and Mother at that point. Because really, the direct Fatherness of the Father that people experience is absolute, or at best co-infinite, and this is infinite. This is above that. Yeah. We're talking about that interface between the infinite upholder and the Paradise Trinity. And if you look on the ellipse chart, without getting into all the details, fundamentally, the infinite upholder is here in the sixth functional level, but that gets extended through the seventh by that which extends the infinite capacity. And when it does that, so the infinite upholder is directly in contact with the first functional level. And what's in the first functional level? The Paradise Trinity. There's an intimate, direct interface between the infinite upholder and the Paradise Trinity. And that's what's between the lines here, what they comment. I mean, the very fact that you're seeing some mysterious, very transcendent coordination between thought adjusters and inspired Trinity spirits is related to the fact that the infinite upholder and the Paradise Trinity have an interface at a very, very transcendent high level, that boundary between the seventh and the first functional levels, is what's, you know, they're noticing is manifest to a degree. They can tell that there's something very tightly, you know, coordinated going on there. Right? So, you know, having worked through total deity, you can... you can fill this out a little bit more than they were certainly allowed to say directly.
So do you think that they could, so the thought adjuster knows everything that, you know, knows what we're thinking and so forth. Do you think this, since they're associated with them, they must have some relationship to us too?
Yeah, and of course, as we've pointed out, an awful lot of beings know what we're thinking and stuff, you know, what a basic nature of ourself is. But you could, you know, be very suspicious that there could be some very, very close connection here between adjusters and inspired Trinity spirits where they know it, their knowledge is more intimate than others' knowledge of ourselves. Because, of course, the adjuster is literally in our mind. And something that was very close to it would, you know, have a almost as intimate a connection to us. It also makes you wonder about, occasionally they mention that what's in the mind of a thought adjuster is made aware to the ancients of days and the universal censors in curious ways. Well, maybe the inspired Trinity spirits have something to do with that. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Trinity origin beings, and these are in Trinity origin beings as well. Ancients of Days, universal censors, inspired Trinity spirits. There could be a real coordination going on there, and maybe the secret is the closeness of inspired Trinity spirits to adjusters.
Could it be that they are of the substance of the absonite upholder?
Well, you would see, when you're thinking about them as super persons, they're in the womb of God the ultimate is God the Mother, you know, they're being upheld by the absolute upholder as directly as fact, as personalized selves. Yeah. And see, that's what I was saying. You mean the Trinity of ultimacy? See, is there, you know, an immediacy with their nature? Okay, so, see, there's actually a whole bunch of stuff there. And again, it just, notice the fact that we've figured out what the thought adjusters are a fragment of, what part of the Father they're a fragment of, allows you to have sort of immediate recognition of some of the higher, more advanced things that are coursing through some of these paragraphs. All right?
The inspired spirits do not apparently belong to the evolutionary scheme of the individual planets or universes, and yet they seem to be almost everywhere. Even as I am engaged in the formulation of this statement, my associated solitary messenger's personal sensitivity to the presence of this order of spirit indicates that there is with us at this very moment, not over 25 feet away, a spirit of the inspired order and of the third volume of power presence. The third volume of power presence suggests to us the probability that three inspired spirits are functioning in liaison.
Now, to go a little bit beyond the immediate, notice how carefully worded that is. You know, when they say probability that three, you know, okay, I mean, if it was just straightforward that in order to get a power, a third volume of power presence registry, that it meant there's three beings there, he wouldn't be fuzzing it. So there must be other ways that you can get a third volume of power presence, but they're concluding that it's just simply because there's three ones, 1 + 1 + 1 = 3, okay? Well, apparently, maybe sometimes there's a single individual, but that one individual is a 3 or a 2 or...
It registers higher.
Yeah. See, now that would suggest that, you know, see, he's sort of indirect, but you could speculate that what he's not telling you there is that they actually have evidence that there's inspired Trinity spirits that are functioning maybe on all four levels of ultimate personality activity. You know, and so maybe they're 1, 2, 3, and 4, you know, in terms of, you know, a fourth volume of power presence. That's a possibility of a way of rationalizing that, you know, which would indicate that they're beings that are... you know, spread out over all four ages of the absonite. You know, and...
What was that? Say what those four ages...
Just, you know, the fact that you have four outer space levels is tied to the fact that there are four absonite ages. You have to... First, you're going to complete the first level of ultimate personality activity. Then you're going to complete the second level, and then the third level, and then the fourth level of ultimate personality activity. And you know, remember there's groups of ancients or groups of master architects, you know, tied to each of those four stages. And you have master architects are at all four different levels. And some of them are at level 1 personality activity, some are at level 2, some level 3, some level 4.
Solitary's able to pick up on.
What was that?
The solitary's able to meter all.
Yeah. See. So you're getting the sense that, you know, that maybe a little bit more that the solitary can do than what they're directly revealing, is actually get a sense of how transcendent and inspired Trinity spirit this is. Is it just slightly transcendent, first outer space level sort of, you know, being, or is it very, very transcendent?
And the solitary messenger was at one time an ascendant being?
No, that's a mighty messenger.
Mighty
messenger.
Solitary messengers are very, very, you know, that's the infinite spirit making these very high beings, yeah.
That's
your first doctrine.
There's supreme ultimate stuff associated with solitary messengers are very high beings.
And that's their first, her first?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Firstborn.
Okay, so...
Think about it, Chris.
Yep.
I want to What a nice precision there.
Yeah, they could. So they have to have that kind of sensitivity and awareness because they're speeding out through the universe like
yeah.
they do. They don't want to run into something.
Yeah, they have a very fine sensitivity. Anyway, let's read the next paragraph and you see a little bit more about it.
Of the more than 12 orders of beings associated with me at this time, the solitary messenger is the only one aware of the presence of these mysterious entities of the Trinity. And further, while we are thus apprised of the nearness of these divine spirits, we are all equally ignorant of their mission. We really do not know whether they are merely interested observers of our doings, or whether they are, in some manner unknown to us, actually contributing to the success of our undertaking.
See, okay, so read between the lines there. That last line, another way you could say that last line is, I wonder if they are actually inspiring this mission to some degree. See?
They don't say inspiring, they
see?
Say inspired.
Right, see. So you're starting to see why they use that word in their name. Just this, the way they interact in this. It's like, are they an unseen inspiration in what's going on here? Is there an inspiriting, is there a presence of unity throughout this that is not immediately apparent, that's bringing it all together as one? See? Okay.
We know that the Trinity Teacher Sons are devoted to the conscious enlightenment of universe creatures. I have arrived at the settled conclusion that the inspired Trinity spirits, by superconscious techniques, are also functioning as teachers of the realms. I am persuaded that there is a vast body of essential spiritual knowledge, truth indispensable to high spiritual attainment, which cannot be consciously received. Self-consciousness would effectively jeopardize the certainty of reception. If we are right in this concept, and my entire order of being shares it, it may be the mission of these inspired spirits to overcome this difficulty, to bridge this gap in the universal scheme of moral enlightenment and spiritual advancement. We think that these two types of Trinity origin teachers affect some kind of liaison in their activities, but we do not really know.
Well, let me just comment on that. I mean, that's not a huge leap, again, because the totality attitude and the coordinate action, okay. But that there would be some kind of liaison. But see, again, now you're really seeing in a very personal way about why the word inspired is in the name. You know, they suspect, the divine counselors suspect that all of us in varying degrees, at least at some point in our universe career, will be inspired, inspirited by their teaching, by their presence, their engagement of us. Okay, so that now you see there's several reasons, both just the kind of the nature that they're a transcendent being, so that all of their engagement would be an insertion into the finite and be inspiriting it. But they stick with that theme, basically. That's what they do. You know, all their efforts seem to be this very subtle, superconscious inspiriting of the affairs of the finite, giving us part of the way to the absentite. The finite has to have a literal way to get to the absentite. It can't just magically transcend. It can get to the absentite. We can become seven-stage spirits, for instance, at some point, because beings like this have prepared the way. There's a little bit of eventuation in all of us.
Yeah.
It's all there from the beginning. And so it's not a coincidence that it's there at the end.
Interesting how self-consciousness isn't serviceable for this.
Yeah, and this, of course, just that fact. I mean, you start to think about that. Okay, what's a more general sort of principle I could pull out of that? We all know that in terms of using the three cosmic intuitions, having a relationship to the Holy Spirit, to the universal harmony, the trick is to not get in the way.
Yeah.
That really all you can do is get in the way. Can you humble yourself enough, your animal origin, adjutant-minded self, can you master that enough, humble it enough, because it's incessantly clamoring to not be humble, can you master it, make it humble enough that it doesn't mess up the possibility that you could, for instance, get some inspiration from an inspired Trinity Spirit? Guaranteed, you're not going to get anything from this high if there's even one shred of animal origin clamoring going on in your head. If you have one shred of thought about yourself or about material things, you're not going to get anything from them, you know, guaranteed. Okay, it's hard for even things that can reach down really low to get you, you know, in those circumstances. But certainly something this subtle and transcendent, no, forget about any help from them.
Now, is it because of intent by them, or is it just it just wouldn't register?
Right. It's not because they're, you know, dissing you. Like, well, I'll teach Gene. I'm not going to give him any help. No, they can't. I mean, it's just like the adjuster.
Look at the straitjacket.
Well, you know, when you're a churning puddle of froth, I mean, the adjuster can't do anything for you. You know, and if you think the adjuster is doing something for you, you're delusional. You know, it's not doing anything for you. It's impossible.
Lines, it almost is an admonition not to try to
proselytize things,
but to just, you know, let these agencies do their work.
Right, there's always this very tricky relationship between allowing the Father's way to be, yeah, the evolutional way, evolutionary way, and, well, when am I supposed to do a father-like thing and kind of insert myself? When is that in coordination with the Supreme, and when is it? When isn't it? There's a very hard-to-answer question. That's why, by and large, you should probably just start out really humble and working close to home, like between your ears, before you try to branch out. If you're supposed to be branching out some, it will become naturally apparent within the cosmic harmony that you've established in your mind that that is the right thing to do and not just a self-righteous thing to do. I want to proselytize because, you know, I have this self-righteous notion that this is the way and everyone needs to adopt it or die. That sort of self-righteous evangelism, which is, you know, the common thing throughout all history. And, you know, in some religions, you literally pick up a sword when you evangelize. Because you see it in a very definitive one or the other fashion. You know, it's not like, well, you can, you know, it's not a choose now or suffer the consequences later. No, you choose now or suffer the consequences now. You know, no damnation down the future or something because you choose to join my religion. You know, I'm just going to kill you right now. So, yeah, see, just there's actually all kinds of analogies or patterns. There's pattern here. Like I said, look, figure out the pattern on high and then bring it home. How does this directly apply to you? Because none of this is disjoint from you. You are experiencing this same pattern in some way. Figure it out. And then you're beginning to find the truth that you can obey in the revelation. The facts about supreme ultimate personality activity, you can't obey that. But the pattern in it, through which truth flows, that you can obey that same truth. So you got to find that. You got to go beyond the facts.
On the super universe training worlds and on the eternal circuits of Havona, I have fraternized with the perfecting mortals, spiritualized and ascendant souls from the evolutionary realms, but never have they been aware of the inspired spirits, which ever and anon the powers of detection resident in the solitary messengers would indicate were very near us. I have freely conversed with all orders of the sons of God, high and low, and they likewise are unconscious of the admonitions of the inspired Trinity spirits. They can and do look back in their experiences and recount happenings which are difficult to explain if the action of such spirits is not taken into account. but accepting solitary messengers and sometimes Trinity origin beings, none of the celestial family have ever been conscious of the nearness of the inspired spirits.
You know, when they say sons of God high and low, for instance, a creator son. Okay. God. You know, is still struggling with the mystery of this. Okay, this is their high, very high facts. You know, it really helps you to not get creator sons too high in your sense of things, scheme of things. You know, he's questioned creator sons, and the creator sons said, no, I have never, and I'm God, and I have never seen one. But I'm pretty sure that there was this one time when what I was doing must have been inspired to a degree by their presence, because I couldn't have done that on my own. And again, an admission of humility, you know, limitation on the part of God. Something that you just don't have outside of the fifth epical revelation, being challenged to think about God in limited ways like that. All right. I guess that's... maybe just one other little thing there. You know, why does he bring up us there? Did that strike you as odd? I mean, he says, you know, I've fraternized with perfecting mortals, you know, and why is that even relevant? It's like, well, of all the beings in the universe, you know, wouldn't I be the last one that could see one? What's the thing?
Trinity origin.
Remember, this tie, the fact that we are this very subtle Trinity origin phenomenon, that's why he's queried us. And well, if you've gotten to that point of, you know, perfect consecration of your will, do you see him? Do you sense him? You know, no. So actually, again, that reminds you that you need to have a Trinity origin expression that has some minimal measure of highness to it. You know, in a sense, you know, we're welling up from the lowest of the low and moving towards seventh stage spirits that are going to have complete supremacy embodied within them and are going to be more face-to-face with the divine counselor in nature. Yeah. So that's what he's querying. You know, he's like, well, no, yeah, we seem to have very definite confirmation that they're relatively high beings, because Trinity origin phenomena that are still pretty lowly are clueless, like us.
Yeah. I do not believe the inspired Trinity spirits are playing hide-and-seek with me. They are probably trying just as hard to disclose themselves to me as I am to communicate with them. Our difficulties and limitations must be mutual and inherent. I am satisfied that there are no arbitrary secrets in the universe. Therefore, will I never cease in my efforts to solve the mystery of the isolation of these spirits belonging to my order of creation.
Insatiable curiosity. Do you have insatiable curiosity like this divine counselor? If not, you want to be insatiably curious. You know that curiosity doesn't really come into play until you get some Adamic uplift. Don't be a sangic bump on a log. Okay? Find some andite curiosity and put it into practice. Yeah. Not playing hide and seek, but that one paragraph sounded like peekaboo.
You didn't rule that out.
Yeah. The solitary messengers, guess what? There's one within 25 feet of us. Peekaboo. I couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
Handy tool to have in their toolbox, the solitaire.
All right, what was that last one there?
And from all this, you mortals, Just now taking your first step on the eternal journey, can well see that you must advance a long way before you will progress by sight and material assurance. You will long use faith and be dependent on revelation if you hope to progress quickly and safely.
If you hope to progress quickly and safely. Yeah. Danger.
Danger, right? That's implied.
All right. You want to keep reading?
Sure.
Oh, well, maybe just one little preface. Okay, so remember now the last two little sections here are getting closer to home. Creatures, instead of these very transcendent beings and gods and whatnot, homona natives and paradise citizens. And I can't say much about paradise citizens, but they give us a number of fun little tidbits here about homona natives and our relationship to them.
6. Homona natives. The homona natives are the direct creation of the paradise trinity, and their number is beyond the concept of your circumscribed minds.
Ouch.
Neither is it possible for your ancients to conceive of the inherent endowments of such divinely perfect creatures as these Trinity origin races of the eternal universe. You can never truly envisage these glorious creatures. You must await your arrival in Havona when you can greet them as spirit comrades.
Remember, so be very humble about the word spirit. The real engagement of spirit issues doesn't happen until you get to Havona. By and large, even all the grandiose things you do getting all the way to Uversa, it's just spiritual preparatory school, you know, even there. So, you know, humans that think that they absolutely know about spirit on this planet are delusional. Just read between the lines there.
Possibly unsafe.
Possibly dangerous for all of us. All right, they're trying to point out, you just have no idea yet about what we're really talking about when we're talking about spirit energy or the purposeful engagement of spirit energy, you know, so that it's real, not just an actuality. Yeah, I mean, as a first-stage spirit, you're going to start to really get a sense of the actuality of it. But the reality doesn't come into full play until you get to Havona. So you can't even remotely imagine what you're talking about when you're talking about a Havona native. They're a lot higher than mortals on post-bestowal worlds, for instance. And they tell us we can't even imagine mortals on post-bestowal worlds, let alone Havona natives. We are so not spiritual right now. Okay?
Too much hair.
During your long sojourn on the billion worlds of Havona culture, you would develop an eternal friendship for these superb beings. And how deep is that friendship which grows up between the lowest personal creature from the worlds of space and these high personal beings native to the perfect spheres of the central universe? Ascending mortals, in their long and loving association with the Havona natives, do much to compensate for the spiritual impoverishment of the earliest stages of mortal progression. At the same time, through their contacts with ascending pilgrims, the Havoners gain an experience which to no small extent overcomes the experiential handicap of having always lived a life of divine perfection. The good to both ascending mortal and Havona native is great and mutual.
Okay, so very basically, that superadditive consequence that they're alluding to there. When you first get to Havona and are working your way through. Oh, and did you notice that they said long, and then they reminded you they said long? Long, long time there. Okay. You have a perfecting creature in a personal relationship with a perfect creature. The superadditive consequence of the relationship between a perfect creature and a perfecting creature is a perfected creature. You know, in order for you to become perfected, you have to have this relationship with these perfect creatures. That's why you go through Havana, for this superadditive consequence that they're referring to. Now, of course, if we have a super additive consequence, and it's very definitive, going from perfecting to perfected. The Havona natives must have some very definitive super additive consequence of their relationship to us as well. What is it? See if they give some more clues.
Learn some swear words.
Well, you know, when we have, you have a perfection of purpose when you, in order to get into the doors of Havona. So remember how I told you there's an economy to Havona? There's laws of the house. I think no swearing is one of the laws of the house, yeah.
Right. Havona natives, like all other Trinity origin personalities, are projected in divine perfection. And as with other Trinity origin personalities, the passing of time may add to their stores of experiential endowments. But unlike the stationary sons of the Trinity, Havoners may evolve in status, may have an unrevealed future eternity destiny. This is illustrated by those Havoners whose service factualized capacity for fusion with a non-adjuster father fragment and so qualify for membership in the mortal core of the finality. And there are other finaliter cores open to these natives of the central universe.
Okay, this is a very important little clue paragraph in the book. This super additive consequence. They can service factualize capacity. Yeah, capacity, that's a mother word. Okay. And they're gonna fuse with a father fragment, you know, not like our father fragment, but a father fragment. Well, what fuses with the father fragment in our case? The soul. Mm-hmm. And this soul, you know, it's a literal volume. It's a copy of the volume of the temple within, in a sense, and its contents. And who made the temple within? The creative mother spirit. So, you know, think about it. What are they? They're saying that there's a super additive consequence. That's going on here. They're developing a soul equivalent, at least, here. Something that's going to be fusible with a father fragment. They weren't created that way or trinitized that way. They weren't brought into existence that way with this potential for a father fragment to fuse. But they can develop, they can factualize, literally change their nature so that a father fragment can fuse with them. It's like, well, for us to develop a soul, we needed a thought adjuster. We needed to be in a relationship with a thought adjuster for that fact to come into existence, you know, for that potential to factualize as, you know, as an actuality. Do you remember what they said, another mysterious little passing statement, about some Trinity related beings that we've read about here just recently that are in Havona, the circuit spirits? Remember what they said about how the circuit spirits relate to the Havona natives in a way like the thought adjuster relates to us? See, now put it all together. See, so through that relationship between the Havona native and they're immersed in this presence of the circuit spirits, they factualize some sort of soul equivalent within their nature that a father fragment can fuse to. And they can then join one of the finality cores. Now, they mention the mortal core, but for instance, there's the core of Havona finaliters. Yeah, directly. Yeah. So, all that's between the lines there. And I flesh out some of those details in the Pattern Universe paper when you're trying to sort out all the relationship between what's going on in the central universe and what's happening out here, and how there's this reciprocal parallel phenomenon between what's going on inside and what's going on outside in the super universes, and kind of in the spirit of the inspired, that pattern and those doings in the central universe are an inspiration, you know, for the pattern and the doings out here.
they be six-stage equivalents at that point? Mm-hmm. They would be seventh stage.
Well, you know, it's a little hard to understand how to think about Avona natives. You notice that they use the word evolve. Okay, so they're reminding you that even though in many ways the central universe is absentite, not totally. You know, to use the word evolve, you have to have finite phenomena in play. Finite things evolve. Absentite things eventuate.
So I don't know. They must achieve that through the relationship with us.
I mean, yeah, it seems pretty likely that if they're inducted into the mortal core of the finality, some of these Avona natives that fuse, they must have a similar nature to us as six-stage spirits. But that's not the only core they go into. So, see. So you don't want to be too certain about putting them in a small box. Especially those Havona finaliters, that's a kind of a mysterious category. All right, so just to say, don't let something that's that fraught with mystery pass forever. You know, try to constantly be coming back over the years of studying this revelation, you know, to a mysterious paragraph like that and try to figure out what are they referring to there. Put some pieces together, like that mysterious comment about the circuit spirits and the Havona natives.
The status evolution of Havona natives has occasioned much speculation on Uversa, since they are constantly filtering into the several paradise cores of finality, and since no more are being created, it is apparent that the number of natives remaining in Havona is constantly diminishing. The ultimate consequences of these transactions have never been revealed to us, but we do not believe that Havona will ever be entirely depleted of its natives. We have entertained the theory that Havoners will possibly cease entering the finaliter core sometime during the ages of the successive creations of the outer space levels. We have also entertained the thought that in these subsequent universe ages, the central universe may be peopled by a mixed group of resident beings, a citizenship consisting only in part of the original Havona natives. We do not know what order or type of creature may be thus destined to residential status in the future Havona, but we have thought of 1. The Univitatia, who are at present the permanent citizens of the local universe constellations. 2. Future types of mortals who may be born on the inhabited spheres of the super universes in the flowering of the ages of light and life. 3. The incoming spiritual aristocracy of the universe, correction, of the successive outer universes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a bunch of things there. So first of all, you know, it's like, wait a minute, weren't we just talking about, we were talking about solitary messengers being depleted. So you got a similar pattern here. The Havona natives are slowly being taken out of their original apparent service, going into different job categories, and they don't know exactly what's going to happen there. Are we going to run out of Havona natives at some point, or what? You know, the very fact that they call them Havona natives is, you know, kind of what they're saying there, that they don't think that they're ever going to totally, you know, be not there as natives. So it supports the name that they chose for them, using that native term as opposed to citizens. Okay. Okay, and then they get into some speculation. And, you know, we know that things have evolved in the past and they're going to continue to evolve going forward in that central universe. That's the thing about the central universe. You know, that one turning is sort of a one turning for all time. It's not, one day local universes go away, you know, maybe even super universes. But the central universe is this very special universe, that it's sort of the end from the beginning, sort of a universe. Now, why on earth, of all the beings, you know, you're thinking, oh, I wonder who they're going to speculate, and they pull out Univitatia. Why Univitatia? I mean, why would that be, why would they be suspect? You know, why not Susatia, or, you know, or, I mean, why Univitatia? Well, where are they? Where are the Univitatia right now? Constellation level. Who directs things at the constellation level?
Faithful.
The Most Highs direct it. And especially when a local universe is getting settled in light and life, those Most Highs have a very intimate, sort of deputy-like relationship to the Ancients of Days. And the Ancients of Days are really close kin to the Eternals of Days in Havona. Okay, see, so they're that's the dot-to-dot they're doing. They're connecting that together, suspecting that that in a sense you've got some permanency of residence in Havona pattern that's been downstepped and is expressing as these permanent quote-unquote citizens of the constellation level in the Univitatia, and then at some point that little sidewalk will roll back up again, and you know, in a sense, and they won't be a foretaste of that feast to come. They will literally be that feast of being residents of Havona. That's their speculation, and it's certainly possible. You can connect the dots pretty easily. You know, and then fun things like, well, the Havona is the Trinity place, and maybe future types of mortals who may be born on inhabited spheres, maybe there's going to be more definitively from the get-go Trinity origin look, you know, functioning mortals in the late stages, rather than these really hard to recognize Trinity origin creatures like we are right now. And they would be much more immediately suited to be the new natives of the Trinity's domain of Havona. That's what's going on there. And then the last one, you know, just notice the challenge to you. The incoming spiritual aristocracy. Okay, does the run-of-the-mill idealism on this planet like the word aristocracy? Does it like the word oligarchy?
No.
Not hardly. No, those are bad words. If you're going to be a, you know, if you're going to have any street cred as an idealist, you certainly don't want to, you know, be holding up a banner for aristocracy or oligarchy. That's who you think, you know, should be put down. Spiritual aristocracy. Okay. They're trying to challenge you there. This is a hierarchical universe. I mean, if you reject aristocracy, if you reject oligarchy, that's called anarchy, where there is no hierarchy. And who tried to bring the notion of no vertical structure? Yeah. The second principle of the Lucifer Manifesto is that there is no hierarchy. You know, oligarchies are to be hated, foreign potentates, okay, etc. Okay, or even those Most Highs. You know, who the heck they think they are, calling themselves Most High? There is no vertical structure. Most High, my foot. Okay. See, that's what's.
Yeah.
You know, recognize the challenge there.
Who do they think God is? If you really, you know, he isn't just the oligarchy of all time.
There is no quote-unquote God like that. Lucifer is the God of liberty. God is a label that you apply to yourself.
Oh.
Right. How's
that for pancakes?
Okay. So, yeah, that's a simple example. I mean, take that out of the, you know, when you say successive outer universe, like, oh, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me. No, it has a huge thing to do with why this book is on this planet. We've got a serious problem with this this issue of the hierarchy. You've got spiritually conscious people who are unwittingly going right down the Lucifer path. Okay. First step is get rid of all, get rid of any sense of the word, of the adjective material in front of your word idealism. If you're going to see yourself as an idealist, it has to be devoid of material idealism, your idealism. Because all material idealism is false. It has to be pure spiritual idealism. But even when you get it purely in the spiritually idealistic mode, so that you're not trying to figure out what the perfect arrangement of things is on the planet, that's, you know, what's ideal, but you see it as a unity question, a spirit question, an actual genuine spirit question. But even then, spiritual aristocracy, even when you get it purely spiritual in your contemplation of idealism, you must humble yourself in the hierarchy. Don't fall into that thing, well, unity means unity. If there's unity, there can't be a hierarchy. It has to all be the same. No, you have planes of unity, but they're hierarchically ordered. There's higher and higher planes of unity. Don't think you can turn the horizontal vertical. Yeah.
I think the problem we have on this planet with aristocracy and oligarchy is that the individuals that inhabit those categories are not worthy of being looked up to in so many instances. If we actually lived in a system in which the structure of and those placed above us truly were worthy of respect, it would be a completely different thing.
Like a system sovereign? Mm-hmm. You know, like material sons and daughters on Gerasim looking up to their divine system sovereign? No. The answer is not better aristocracy. Lucifer is a lot better aristocracy than any aristocracy we've ever had here. The answer is objective consciousness. Can you see the concept of aristocracy and oligarchy objectively rather than subjectively? Just, are you wholly subject to false aristocracies, minimalistic aristocracies? Does that subjective experience define the truth of aristocracy? That's the challenge. Can you rise above your subjective relationship to aristocracy and oligarchy? Even autocracy. Remember how they talk about divine autocracy? Okay, forget about oligarchy. Okay, now we're talking autocracy. That's the challenge. Can you recognize that God the Father is the definition of Father, rather than the worst father that you've ever experienced on the planet? Can you understand, can you relate to the word Father objectively, or do you only relate to it subjectively? And then you use the mind projection fallacy. Yeah. What I experience is, I experienced a bad oligarchy, therefore all oligarchies are bad, because I define the nature of reality. My experiences do anyway. No. See, that's a subjective mind. But notice everyone just does that without thinking about it. That's just your knee-jerk animal origin mode of thought. It's not objective. It's lower domain of the hourglass. Yeah, that's what these challenges are about. And don't cast your pearls before swine. Spiritual aristocracy are pearls. Don't take the first thing that comes along and calls itself aristocracy at face value. It's like, well, he says he's part of the aristocracy, so I will just mindlessly bond myself to him. Have some wisdom. And you need it for a long ways yet, because, say you're an angel. You know, while here, we're ascending up very parallel to the nature of angels. 200,000 years ago, you know that your boss went bad. And yet, you must obey your superiors. Matter of fact, you're designed so that you really have a hard time not obeying your superiors. You're designed to be very subjective. You just, okay. You just do whatever they say. You're practically machine-like, you know, in your lack of self-initiating independent thinking. Angels are very subject to a false leader. But you got a really good object lesson 200,000 years ago that you need always be thinking independently, courageous and independent cosmic thinking, because you never know. One day your boss might go bad again. And you've got to distinguish between true and false leadership. So, you know, it's going to be a very, very long time before there won't be false aristocracies on this planet. You know? And it's not just, they aren't just here because the rebellion is a fault. Every world has false aristocracies. But there are true aristocracies. Yeah. And can you appreciate that even if you haven't yet experienced it? Can you learn by looking or only by leaping? Did you have something, Steve?
Oh. Well, it was just a weird comparison.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I've been in the so-called health food industry for a long, long time. People think, you know, some people think fat is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Bad fat is bad. Good fat is good.
Right.
Carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Carbohydrates aren't bad. Bad carbs are bad.
Wait a minute. You're not suggesting wisdom. Are you?
I'm just suggesting that you can have good and bad,
yeah, yeah,
both of something that, when it's expressed correctly,
yeah,
is good.
Right, right.
And we shouldn't, yeah, make a mistake to just think because you had a bad experience that,
right,
all things like that are bad.
Yeah, but we all know how many people think in such simplistic, dichotomous fashion. You know, it's so easy. You know, you have one bad experience, you just universalize that. You know, and you never have to think about it again. All people with that hair color are bad. No thought required ever again. Just make your sign and go out and start, you know, protesting against people with that hair color. You know, that we all know that it sounds silly, but it's almost universal. This is the way most people think. It's sad to record that so few persons on Urantia can have an objective relationship to something.
George Orwell's whole book, Animal Farm, is that four legs bad, two legs good, and all the...
it's hard to keep it straight when it's, you know, when it's so arbitrary.
Four legs good, two legs bad, yeah.
You know, or stars upon Mars, not stars upon Mars, if you're a Dr. Seuss fan. Yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, we've played this theme a lot. Let's keep going so we don't run out of time here.
We know that the Havona of the previous universe age was somewhat different from the Havona of the present age. We deem it no more than reasonable to assume that we are now witnessing those slow changes in the central universe that are anticipatory of the ages to come. One thing is certain, the universe is non-static. Only God is changeless.
And of course, why do they throw in that last thing? Just what we were just going on and on and on about. You know, it's so easy to initially assume, when you have some sense of unity, that the divinity is static, and that those are synonyms, and that, you know, if something changes, it's bad. If glaciers melt, it's bad. Or, you know, if Florida sinks, it's bad, or whatever, you know. It's like a lot of land has risen and sunk and risen and sunk. And, you know, I mean, change, you know, the universe is non-static. You know, a simple little, taking one semester course in historical geology will give you a lot different perspective on the coastlines than a lot of blogs do. Okay? coastlines are not innately divine. They change. Okay?
Along with icebergs.
All right, then they give us just the little snippet about Paradise Citizens, and then there's a fun little epilogue that they tack on here that we want to talk about a little bit.
7. Paradise Citizens. There are resident on Paradise numerous groups of superb beings, the Paradise Citizens. They are not directly concerned with the scheme of perfecting ascending will creatures, and are not, therefore, fully revealed to Urantia mortals. There are more than 3,000 orders of these supernal intelligences, the last group having been personalized simultaneously with the mandate of the Trinity, which promulgated the creative plan of the 7 superuniverses of time and space. Paradise Citizens and Havona natives are sometimes designated collectively as Paradise Havona personalities.
Or even Paradise Havoners. You know, and a lot of times it's when you're doing what we were just talking about. If you're trying to talk about those, for instance, those Trinitized Sons of Destiny, you know, it's a finaliter in relationship to either a Havona native or a Paradise Citizen. You know, and you want to lump those together that because the distinction is not relevant to that phenomenon of the creature Trinitized Son. So you'll call them Paradise Havona personalities, Paradise Havoners collectively like that. One little clue there, besides saying there's, you know, more than 3,000 orders, so it's like, oh my goodness, the stuff they haven't revealed is huge. But that last little clue, the last group having been personalized simultaneously with the mandate of the Trinity, which promulgated the creative plan of the 7 superuniverses of time and space. Well, actually, a couple things in there. Oh my goodness. The mandate of the Trinity? Yeah, remember, it is a Trinity-administered domain. It's like, wow, I hadn't thought about that, that this whole bringing this 7 superuniverses into existence was mandated by the Trinity, not by the Father, the Son, or the Spirit. You know, and it's the pattern universe for what's going on out here is, you know, Trinity's domain and the central universe. So there's just notice that actually most things are about the Trinity. This is one of the amazing things about the fifth epical revelation. I mean, they're just turning the whole history on its head. And we've tried to rationalize basically everything as being the Father did this, the Father did that. Actually, the Father did not a lot, you know, in terms of finite, you know, direct stuff. He initiated at the infinite level and stuff, yeah. But the details come down from the Trinity through the Mother. Yeah. Okay.
He has his hands full just holding himself out.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a big hands to hold up the infinite level. You know, he's got his hands full on the infinite level. Okay. So there's that. But then they're giving you a little clue there, too, that even though you talk about the Eternal Isle, I mean, and it's like, well, you know, the Eternal Isle, that shouldn't have any immediate connection to time-space affairs, but look what they just said. Apparently there's a spectrum of Paradise Citizens, some that are very much on the no relationship to finite, you know, space-time actions at all, very, very eternal, all the way right up to the border, where the last group is in some sort of reciprocal, reflective relationship to starting up the 7 superuniverses. So I'm giving you a sense that there's a spectrum, see, with an interface on our side. Okay, see, that's a clue about those 3,000. That it isn't just, you know, you're going along, there's all kinds of creatures, and then way up above transcendent, there's these 3,000. No, there's this whole spectrum, one of which is sort of right on the boundary to immediate relationship to us. All right, then there's this fun little thing they throw in the end here.
This completes the story of those beings who are brought into existence by the Paradise Trinity. None of them have ever gone astray. And yet, in the highest sense, they are all free will endowed. Trinity origin beings possess prerogatives of transit which make them independent of transport personalities, such as seraphim. We all possess the power of moving about freely and quickly in the universe of universes. Accepting the inspired Trinity spirits, we cannot attain the almost unbelievable velocity of the solitary messengers, but we are able so to utilize the sum total of the transport facilities in space that we can reach any point in a super universe from its headquarters in less than 1 year of your Urantia time. It required 109 days of your time for me to journey from Uversa to your Urantia.
Okay, so we want to think about some of those things. But let's start at the beginning. Start that first sentence. Think about it in a way you probably haven't before. Trinity origin beings possess prerogatives of transit which make them independent of transport personalities. When you leave paradise, the Isle of Paradise, as a finaliter, do you need a transport angel? Oh, put two and two together. You don't need a transport personality. Trinity origin beings possess prerogatives of transit, which makes them independent. You're a Trinity origin being. That's why you can do that finaliter self-transporting thing. And you're revealing God the Mother. And you leave. Right? You're taking an oath to the Paradise Trinity. And you're going to go work in the domain that the Trinity mandated into existence. And it's the Trinity. The Trinity is the key thing to come into an understanding of. If you're going to really understand who you are, what your origin, history, and destiny is.
Yeah. So this 109 days...
Okay, well, we're going to get that. You're all on this. Okay, 109 days. So let's start with that. 109 days to go from Uversa to Urantia. How far is it from Uversa to Urantia?
I was going to ask if they're in a
Okay, go ahead.
Are they in a transport facility of some kind? It says that they can utilize some total of the transport facilities.
Okay. No. I mean, you're limited. Look up the word facility in the dictionary. You'll find it has a little bit more general sense.
Okay.
The means. You know, there's...
Okay.
There's energy presences and lanes afoot in the universe, and they can utilize all that. So then specifically, how far is it from Uversa to Urantia? They tell you. Do you remember?
200 million light years.
Not million.
200,000.
200,000 light years. Okay, so if you go at the speed of light, to go from Uversa to Urantia, it'll take you 200,000 years.
Okay.
So he does it in 109 days. That's a lot less than 200,000 years. Okay. So how many times the speed of light does he go? So you can calculate it. It's very simple. Just it's 670,000 times the speed of light. Remember, you know, he mentioned the unbelievable velocity. That one example of solitary messengers, that was 4.5 million times the speed of light. Okay, so here you can see that's almost seven times faster than this. Okay, that's why it's unbelievable. But still, this is clipping. Okay.
Fast enough for this work.
When you make that calculation, okay, so he's going at about 670,000 times the speed of light. What else did they tell you here? What was the other little data point they put in there? Right before that.
From the center.
Okay. We can reach any point in a super universe from its headquarters in less than 1 year. Well, you know how fast he goes. You know how the time... You've got a velocity and a time. You can calculate a distance.
Yep. Now you know the size.
Okay. Okay, so remember, a super universe, you know, they tell you that It's, you know, basically flat relative to its radial width. You know, it's a lot wider this way than it is thick. You know, and the Milky Way, of course, is very disc-shaped. And then they tell you it's a lot longer, you know, around the circuit than it is, you know, than its breadth, and it's radially wide. Okay. But they don't tell you, well, how much is, you know, a lot longer? Well, put the pieces together, and you can get a little sense. I mean, if he can go 670,000 light years in 1 year, okay, the farthest he could go is if he's going diagonally. You know, let's just think about it in two dimensions.
Can do that in 109 days.
No. Okay, think, you know, if basically the super universe is a rectangular space here that I can journey about starting at the center, okay, and it's, in, you know that this way, you've got something like 500,000 light years plus. There's going to be a little bit of cushion on either radial side of the Milky Way, but you know it's you know, they tell you it's roughly 250 or 500 in diameter. So that gives you kind of a sense of how thick it is. You know, the level is this way, but the length. It's like, well, you know, if he went just parallel to the path. Okay, that's not as far as going diagonally. You know, what if the farthest away from your vertex would be going to the corner of the rectangle. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can estimate, okay, if you kind of know how long the diagonal of the, you know, how long the hypotenuse of the triangle, okay, you know, could be at most 670,000. He says it's less. Okay, so it's not going to be as big as 670,000. And you have a sense of how thick it is this way, you can figure out, well, how long is that long side of the triangle? You see, it's about twice. I mean, twice the length is about twice the width. I mean, for instance, if you assumed, let's say you have 500,000 in diameter, you know, that's basically the Milky Way circle. You know, and then there's this area on front and back where little galaxies are formed and then brought in and stuff. And you're trying to figure out how much, you know, space is there extra in that along in the length direction there, like that. Say, well, it's probably, you know, somehow related to something about 500,000 light years. And I don't know. Let's say I'm going to need some cushion between the innermost circuits here in the dark gravity bodies, maybe give it 50,000 light years. Just use a factor of 10 less. You know, so maybe you have, you know, something like 550 in play there. It's like, well, let me just try a simple guess. Let me assume that, yeah, I have 550 this direction and 550 this direction. You know, so there's a 1.1 million. Total all the way along. So what would I get? If you took 550,000 light years and 300,000 light years for two of the legs of the triangle, you know, what would the hypotenuse be? And you'll see it's just a little bit under 670,000. So that's apparently about what it is. Just kind of what you might even kind of guess as a first just guess. It's like, well, I don't know, maybe make it about twice, you know, and that does work really well. So indirectly here, see, they're telling you basically how long each super universe's stretch is here, and you can add seven of those together. They're telling you how long it is around the circuit. Okay.
Say the number 701.
Well, I mean, if it's something like, you know, 1.1 million, then it'd be 7.7 million light years around the circuit.
Yeah, but isn't there some space in between them?
Well, see, that's, I'm kind of giving it.
For that.
I'm kind of giving it a little bit of that. I'm saying, well, maybe I have 500 and 500, and then I have like 50 on each side. 50, yeah. You know, I'm kind of just throwing a 50 buffer in there. I mean, yeah. Just, you know. So that would be a first rough guess of the how far it is around the circuit.
So if he wanted to just do a lap, he's looking at a 14-year. Take a lap.
And then give me 50 push-ups.
14 years.
See, so that's why it's important to think these through a little bit. I mean, that's how they give you some of this information, is very indirectly like that. You know, nothing is very precise. But even with the guessing maybe a buffer of about 50,000 light years, remember what they said? You know, they tell you that initially you had like 500,000 light years and then a 500,000 light year gap. But that 500,000 light year gap has been evolving. And now, on average, it's more like about 400,000. Well, if I assume it's kind of some evolving symmetrically, that'd be like 50 on each side. And so now you kind of have 50 on both sides of the 500. You know, see, all the numbers seem to kind of play together. So it's a reasonable first estimate.
And our astronomers think that the Milky Way is how?
Well, I mean, they'll usually say that the diameter is like 100,000. It's actually 500,000. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and they also think that we're, what is it? I think they say it's like 20. We're like 23,000 or something like that from the center. Isn't that what they say these days? I think, you know, we're really 200,000. See, so notice that there's a lot of difference. I mean, because it's not a simple error in our distance estimating. It depends on what direction and how far, and we're going to have different errors in different directions and by different means and whatnot.
See if it's variable too.
Yeah. Okay, so about 670,000 times the speed of light, or about 1/7 the speed of a solitary messenger, is what these Trinity origin beings can cruise at. So that's probably you as a finaliter too, see?
There you go, Pam. You still have designs on.
Hey, you can get around. You know, it's not going to take you long to get from point A to point B. But
Trinity Drive.
But you know, step back though. Still, is it you know, even for a divine counselor? Is it just a blink of an eye to go from your verse to here? No, it's a 109-day trip. Okay.
A lot of window time.
Pam and I are
going to
need GPS.
Okay. don't worry, it'll be built in by then. So remember, there's the economy of the super universe level. I mean, it's as big as it can be and still be manageable. You know, when you start thinking, oh, why is the super universe only the size of the Milky Way? Shouldn't it be the size of, you know, several super clusters and stuff? No, because that would be completely unadministratable, unmanageable by finite beings. You know this is just a handful of Trinity origin solid. I mean, the run-of-the-mill being can only go 3 times the speed of light. Okay? You know, and if it's 15 light years from here to Gerasim, it takes you 5 years to get to Gerasim. Okay.
That's how long it takes our souls.
That's a guess. You know, speculation on my part based upon indirect things like this. You know,
experiencing time differently because I mean, what do you do for a cruise like that? You just there and.
Well, again, you have no animal origin boredom thing going on in your head, you know, so that's not an issue. You're insanely curious and working on things the whole way. You're trying to figure out exactly if there's some way that you can divine the nature of those inspired Trinity spirits or something, you know.
You're going to look up and it's like, we're here already?
They don't plug in their iPod.
They don't look like Rocket Man with your phone. rocketing through space as a body.
Well, see, you know, the interesting thing about this, you know, they don't, unlike, transport angels with the whole friction shields and all that sort of stuff, which, so it's kind of like organic spaceships, you know, from our perspective. These, you know, as a finaliter, you're somehow just out there and doing it. You're not in some sort of, so that's a very fascinating thing too, that you can somehow withstand this transport.
Kind of individuation's going on.
You know, I don't know if you, there's probably some navigation required. You can't just fly through, you know, any old dead star or something, you know. But
there's some landmarks along the way.
But still.
So there's a question of how passive this is, or whether he's fully engaged in transport.
See, I mean, obviously, he's transporting himself, so he's got to be engaged. I mean, the transport angel is very engaged. You know, you're in basically sleeping when you're being transported, but the transport angel is fully conscious and, you know, reading his gauges. So, you know, you're gonna be conscious and engaging it. You know, you're gonna, you know, nebula approaching, you know, 12 o'clock, you know, and whatnot. So you're gonna have to be thinking about all that.
Well, at that velocity, you
but yeah, so think about, you know, it's kind of tricky. You know, like, what if you're just gonna go 15 light years? And you go 670,000 times the speed of light. I mean, you got to have precision of on and off.
Yeah.
I mean, you can barely get started and you're already there.
Yeah, you've got to have pulse width modulation.
Where did gravity messages fit into
this? Wait, what was that?
Where did gravity messages fit into this?
Well, remember, gravity messengers don't have any relationship to finite space and time, so their effective speed is infinite.
Yeah,
right.
On off, no matter what.
All right, so they...
And when we go to the outer space levels, we will be... In the company of
gravity. Yeah, but then, of course, see, none of these distances are in play anymore. We're transcending all these finite distances. There's still going to be some sort of absinthe distances that and there's no magic. It'll still take us a certain amount of sequence to go from point A to point B in the absinthe space. But what's now 600,000 light years, say, will be zero distance then. You know, or 500 million light years, you know, out into this outer, you know, second outer space level, that will be zero distance. All those finite distances will be zero. The distances from the super universe level to the second outer space level will be some absinthe distance, which we have no notion of right now. How, you know, is it big, small, you know, I don't know.
Talk about it.
You know, we don't even know what the geometry is going to be. I mean, now we think of it in this very concentric fashion. I mean, what's the geometry going to even be like? And from an absinthe perspective, we don't know. Yeah, I'll work on that, yeah. Well, let's finish up here.
Through these same avenues, we are enabled to intercommunicate instantaneously. Our entire order of creation finds itself in touch with every individual, embraced within every division of the children of the Paradise Trinity, save only the inspired spirits.
Well, the NSA
presented by a divine counselor of Uversa.
Okay, so notice the contrast there. Okay, yeah, 670,000 times the speed of light, but the communication is instantaneous.
Yeah.
It's gravity messenger, you know, transit like. Okay.
Well, that helps.
So there you really see again the totality attitude, you know, and the reflectivity, like ubiquitous presence, that basically all those finite distances are zero. See, that's the thing about reflectivity. It's an expression of that transcendent absinthe geometry in which all finite distances are zero. The diameter of the grand universe is zero from the perspective of the absinthe. So it's easy to be at every point at the same time. It's only one point. You put your finger on it and you're everywhere in the grand universe simultaneously. They're connecting into that, you know, that transcendence of distance in their communication ability, but not in their transport ability.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. I mean, it's one thing to have some sort of connectivity, but when you actually have to cart a form, even if you have some transcendent relationship to finite space and time, like 670,000 times the speed of light is an expression of, you still are somehow, you're relating to point A, and then you're relating to point B. There's a now and a then to it. You know, so you have to translate your relationship, okay, and that takes time. Which will get you thinking a little bit more about this whole notion of thinking of it as this really fast bullet. It's not really a really fast bullet going through finite space and time like we think of it. It's 670,000 times the speed of light. There is no such thing. You know, nothing goes through space and time like we think of a rocket ship or something faster than 1 times the speed of light. You know, the speed of light is the limit for a projectile in the finite. So you don't have this solitary messenger like some projectile screaming through things like we think of it. That's not possible. Okay? It's, you know, in a transcendent sense, it's, you know, first it has its foot here, and then it lifts that foot out, and then it puts its foot here. Okay? And from a finite perspective, you know, it looks like it moved, you know, several inches. You know, and it took a certain time to do that, but it didn't go through. You know, this time thing is how long it takes it to disconnect and then reconnect at a different location. And there's some relationship. It takes it longer to reconnect to a location that's greater finite distance away, but it's a transcendent phenomenon.
A little bit like an airplane flying around this planet can get from London to Denver more quickly by going over Iceland than around.
Yeah, I mean, those sorts of, yeah. I mean, but obviously a lot transcendent of that, but that's the spirit, you know, that there's, you know, I mean, the only thing that we've ever played with in science fiction that's kind of like that is wormholes. You know, that notion that you can go from point A to point B without having to go through all the space in between.
Yeah.
That there's some sort of transcendent, tunnel that you can go through. This is not a magical finite tunnel like a wormhole is. This is just, you're literally a transcendent phenomenon to some degree.
Yeah.
And you don't have, you know, you have a limited relationship to finite space and time.
There's the scene in that movie Contact with Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
Got a little sense of going very fast in there.
That's true. But it's that movie where they had the planet with no
Dune.
That's about Dune.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Transports on Dune.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Just anything like that.
Yeah, just all those sorts of thinking about, you know, trans warp and, you know, and hyperspace and whatnot. Just notice the limitation of all those thoughts, no matter how grandiose they are. They're all some sort of an aggrandized, finite idea. To challenge yourself to not think of the absentite dimensions as just somehow finite-like or, you know, they're transcendent dimensions, and that's a very different thing than just more dimensions or hyper-dimensions or something like that. All right, so there we have it. There's the Trinity origin beings. You can see how we start on the sons of God next. So let's take a moment and reflect on our nature as a Trinity origin being.